ABC Local Radio. Welcome to Sunday Nights. David Rutledge with you for another week. Just one more week. We'll have John Cleary back in the chair next week. I hope you can stay with me for the next 4 hours because we've got a great program lined up. The topic for this week is miracles, and in just a few moments we'll be talking about the realm of the miraculous with our panel, and we'll also be taking your calls a little later in the hour. But first, I just want to tell you a few details about what we've got coming up later in the program. For the second hour this evening, my special guest is John Capper. John is the Academic Dean of Tabor College in Victoria. That's a Christian education and training college. And John has some very interesting stuff to say about theology, the benefits of studying theology, and why it's still an important field of study in 21st century Australia. We'll be talking about the theology of joy. We'll be talking about miracles, because that's our topic for the evening, and about certain aspects of personal grooming, which is a subject close to John's heart. A conversation with John Capper, that's coming up in 1 hour from now. For our third hour tonight, we'll be doing more or less what we did last week, and that's running our quiz as usual. But then for the second half of that hour, we'll have the chat room, and Ian Barnes will be joining me from Perth for a chat and to take some more of your calls. And then finally, in our fourth hour tonight, a feature program on our topic for the evening, miracles. It's a program that explores various perspectives and schools of thought on miracles, and it also opens a window onto some strange phenomena. We'll be encountering a small plastic statue of the Virgin Mary that weeps tears of rose-scented oil. I've seen it with my own eyes, and I didn't know what to make of it, but you can have a listen and see what you think. That's our fourth hour feature tonight. But for this hour, some conversation about all things miraculous with three guests who make up our panel tonight, and I'll be introducing them in just a few moments, and we'll be opening the phone lines a little later on so you can call in and tell us what you think. Maybe you've witnessed a miracle yourself, maybe you wonder why they used to happen in the Bible but they don't seem to happen anymore, maybe you're a rationalist and you think the whole thing's a load of nonsense. Well, your thoughts are welcome, and we'd love to hear them. So that's all coming up over the next 60 minutes here on Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio.
I believe in miracles. Fairy tales don't come true. I believe in miracles. Miracles they do. And I a miracle, the light of the world for all to see. Whoso believeth on him, the truth shall make you free. And I believe in miracles, fairy don't come true. I believe in miracles. Miracles they do. And I make you free. And I believe in miracles. Fairy tales don't come true. I believe in miracles. Miracles they do. Fairy tales don't come true.
Music there from Arthur Alexander, I Believe in Miracles. That's from his album Lonely Just Like Me. It's lovely stuff. Well, Arthur Alexander believes in miracles. I wonder if you do, and I wonder if our guests do this evening. Miracles are the topic of our discussion. There's been an interesting news item that's been doing the rounds over the past couple of weeks, and it has to do with Mary MacKillop. Now, as most of you will probably know, Mary MacKillop was an Australian Catholic nun who died in 1909, and she's probably on track to become Australia's very first saint. And I say probably because the whole process of canonisation, or being officially recognised as a saint, can be a very drawn-out one. Mary MacKillop was first put forward as a candidate for sainthood in 1925, and the business of examining her life and her writings dragged on with various stops and starts until 1992. That's a span of 67 years, at the end of which time her heroic virtue was officially proclaimed by the Vatican, and she was given the title Venerable Mary MacKillop. But that just represented the first few steps on the long road to sainthood. For canonisation, it has to be established that two miracles have taken place as a direct result of the candidate's intercession before God. In the case of Mary MacKillop, it was determined that a woman in 1961, who had apparently been dying, prayed to the Venerable Mary and recovered completely from her illness. So that was the first miracle, and in 1995, Mary was beatified by Pope John Paul II, which means she can now be referred to as Blessed Mary MacKillop. So Saint Mary is only one miracle away. But the problem is that officially sanctioned miracles are increasingly thin on the ground in our secular rationalist age, especially medical miracles, which seem to be the gold standard these days. Examples of people being restored to health after medical science has more or less consigned them to the grave. In 2003, it was hoped that Mary would be canonised when a young boy with an untreatable brain tumour recovered after his family offered up the appropriate prayers. But the problem was that no doctors were willing to come forward and testify that they couldn't explain the boy's recovery in scientific terms. And I think that gets to the heart of the issue that we're exploring tonight. We live in an age where science increasingly claims to be able to explain everything. And in this culture, there's not much room for miracles. That's if you define a miracle as something that runs contrary to the laws of nature. Well, Mary MacKillop has some impressive support. In fact, when Pope Benedict XVI was in Sydney for World Youth Day in July this year, he delighted the Sisters of St. Joseph, that's Mary MacKillop's order, by reportedly saying, "She will be canonised, we're just waiting for the miracle." And earlier this month, it was reported that the Vatican is currently examining evidence in support of that second miracle, a woman who had what was thought to be terminal brain and lung cancer, but who made a full recovery after she prayed to the Blessed Mary for help. And it remains to be seen whether this one gets Mary MacKillop across the line into full sainthood. So what we're going to be talking about this evening is whether or not we feel that miracles are possible, or whether they belong to a less enlightened age, a time when people were not so well educated and more likely to believe that if something really astonishing happened, it had to be because God had decided to break his own laws. Those ironclad natural laws that usually say that you can't walk on water, and you can't turn water into wine, and you certainly can't make a huge body of water like the Red Sea split in two. Does God intervene in nature to perform miracles? And what about all those miracle stories we read in the Bible? Did they really happen? If they did happen, why don't they happen these days? And if they didn't really happen and they're just symbolic, well, what on earth do they mean? So, I'll welcome your thoughts on all of this a little later in the program. But first, we're going to hear from our panel of three distinguished guests who are here tonight to get the ball rolling on some of these questions. Standing by in our Melbourne studio is Andrew McGowan, who's an Anglican priest and associate professor at the Trinity College Theological School at the University of Melbourne. In Canberra, we have the Catholic Auxiliary Bishop of Canberra and Goulburn, Pat Power. And in Sydney, Michael Lyons, who's a pastoral care worker at St. Vincent's Hospital. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining me and welcome to the program.
Thank you, David.
Thanks, David.
Nice to be with you, David.
Thank you very much. Andrew, I'm going to begin with you, Andrew McGowan. And the definition of a miracle that most people recognise is the one that the philosopher David Hume offered in the 18th century. And that's a miracle as the violation of a law of nature. Now, do you think David Hume nailed it there, or is there more to say about what a miracle is?
I think there could be more to say. I can't help but think back to the introductory story you were telling us about Mary MacKillop, where one can't help but perhaps feel a little sorry for the contemporary saint who finds her window of opportunity being increasingly narrowed by the advances of medical science. It seems to me that in many people's experience, miracle isn't perhaps so much the demonstrably the thing that is demonstrably against the laws of nature so much as the thing which is inexplicable. And then the question becomes, do we interpret this in a particular way or not? So Hume's definition works up to an extent, but perhaps it also needs to be acknowledged that it's the product of a modern era which is seeking to define miracles in ways which were perhaps stricter than the way in which the ancient world might have, for instance.
How did the ancient world think about miracles in you know, pre-modern times? How were they understood then?
Well, they certainly understood that there were normal ways in which things might happen in the world and extraordinary ways, and perhaps there's still a real distinction, I think, in the ancient mind, if one can generalise, between the normal and the abnormal. But I think that the world of the ancient past was one which was much more suffused with the supernatural and the divine. And therefore, things which were perhaps miraculous in the sense that they seemed to manifest supernatural power were not necessarily so much contrary to the laws of nature in Hume's terms, because nature itself was, to use another term, understood to be enchanted, to be suffused with meaning and power in a mysterious kind of way and not subject to that kind of rather more modern, rationalist, empiricist sort of view of things.
Mm. But the violation of a law of nature, it seems at a glance to be a pretty good definition of the kind of miracle we encounter in the New Testament, where, you know, Jesus calms the storm and he walks on water and he raises the dead. He seems to specialise in spectacular supernatural acts. And that seems to be the point in a way. You know, God's power is so great that even the wind and waves obey him, as the disciples said.
Yes, I think that there's certainly a sense in which those miracles, those stories, are presented as events that you wouldn't otherwise expect. They're unexpected events, they're remarkable events, they're mysterious events, they're events that demonstrate Jesus' power. But there are also other things that define them a bit more clearly. I mean, they all have some kind of a meaning or message, as it were. Jesus, for instance, foregoes the opportunity that's given to him in the famous stories of his temptation by Satan at the beginning of his ministry. He foregoes the opportunity to undertake certain miracles because they're without meaning or significance except for his own glorification or for his own self-indulgence. So I think the character of a miracle, even though it might well involve it being something extraordinary, something which goes beyond the expected in human phenomena, I think to have theological significance, whether it's ancient or modern, something which claims to be miraculous also needs somehow to be inherently good and life-giving.
Mm. Pat Power, Bishop Pat Power, what do you make of the miracles in the New Testament, or the Old Testament for that matter, these dramatic displays of divine strength? Do you read them as historical events or more as metaphors?
Well, I'd like to go along really with what Andrew was saying, that I wouldn't like to see miracles just as standalone events, but they're always very much in terms of in New Testament terms, the overall teaching of Jesus. And in fact, in St. John's Gospel, they're explicitly referred to as signs of the of what Jesus is all about. And I think just to that wider context in terms of the canonization process is as important as well. That I think we need to look at the whole life of Mary MacKillop, and we need to look too very much at the atmosphere in which her veneration has very much enhanced the lives of the people around her. Anyone that visits the chapel at North Sydney there can't help but be impressed by the very peaceful and the very prayerful atmosphere that there's there. Usually the presence of some of the sisters there giving consolation to the people who are visiting and praying and so on. I think that's really part of the whole story. So it's not so much the miracle itself. I suppose that's the dramatic expression of God's love for us, but I think that's pointing out very much to those everyday expressions of it that I think we can easily overlook if we're looking just to the spectacular.
Mm. So it's not the literal fact of the miracle itself, it's what it represents, what it points to. Is that what you're saying?
I would say that too. And certainly those examples that you gave at the beginning, I think that I'd have no difficulty with regard to the fact that Jesus literally walked on water, that he literally changed water into wine. It might be a different matter, though, with regard to some of the exorcisms that he performed. You mentioned, too, the Old Testament event of the parting of the Red Sea. I'm sure Scripture scholars see that in other terms rather than literal terms.
How would you explain the fact that miracles or miracle claims today tend to cluster around certain denominations? Because that's something that really interests me. We see them in a Catholic context, in a Pentecostal context, but not so much in other denominations. What's going on there, do you think?
Oh, I think a lot of that is very much a cultural thing too. I think that we find God in different areas, and I think one of the things that as Catholics that in the last 100 years that we've come to a greater appreciation of the Scriptures than was the case earlier. And I think that's something that we've certainly learnt very much from our Protestant brothers and sisters, whereas I think some of these more cultural expressions of religion, I think, probably have sat more easily in a Catholic and even in an Orthodox tradition than maybe in a Protestant or an evangelical one.
Well, Michael Lyons, as a pastoral care worker at St. Vincent's Hospital in Sydney, you're dealing with people in desperate straits, people who are very sick or whose family member is very sick. In these sorts of situations, how often do you find people talking about miracles, praying for miracles? Does this sort of thing come up a lot?
Well, excuse me, David, yes, it does. And being in a hospital and in pastoral care, obviously every day we're confronted with situations where people have a serious illness or possibly dying. And the question of why do bad things happen to good people is very close to people's lips most of the time, a question that I can't answer. But I can say that from my observations that people do get transformed spiritually often during the period of sickness and in death. It is quite evident, and you feel it and you touch it. And sometimes we look for miracles, in, as we said, in the extraordinary or the inexplicable, but there's miracles happening around us all the time, I believe. And it's like we look for God in big things, in earthquakes and tsunamis, where he's there in the small things as well. And likewise with the miracles. I believe there's miracles happening all the time, even though we may not term them as people do. Pray for miracles in hospitals, and often their wish, I suppose, is granted when someone recovers from a serious operation. Often they don't. But that doesn't mean that they lose God if they don't, because of their spiritual belief and what happens during say, my interaction with a patient.
But as a pastoral carer, how do you respond if someone says, the doctors have given up hope, but I'm praying for a miracle? Do you join them in that prayer with an open mind?
I most certainly do. And I suppose, like Jesus didn't cure everybody. Like we're not here to cure people, but with to show love and compassion, you feel the suffering of the people enough actually to relieve and comfort them by showing your concern. And it is through this space that you create, I believe, with people that actually believe God enters. And in that space, I believe things do happen that allow the person to continue on their journey.
You talk about the miraculous nature of spiritual transformation and the small things, and I know what you mean there, but what about the large things, the spectacular things? I mean, have you ever witnessed a recovery that you have thought bordered on the miraculous?
I would say not really. You know, I've been at conference with families where the doctor has said, I know one instance where this man, he said to the wife and the daughter, there's really nothing we can do for your husband. He's we can't do any more. And it's only a matter, they can't obviously name the number of days he's got to live, but it's a matter of time. Well, he was in intensive care, and in 2 weeks he actually left intensive care and went back to the ward, and in about 2 months he left the ward in a wheelchair. But he, and I don't know what happened after that, but he had at least, I would believe, 2 more months than they probably thought he would have, the family thought he would have, with him. And that night I remember that we, when you feel so helpless and hopeless sometimes, you do pray. And people who are not traditionally praying type people will join you in prayer. They've got a sense of there is something beyond this. And together you pray and things do happen. Well, that happens a kind of regularly where someone defies, they may eventually die, but they, at least the family gets more time with them.
You mentioned to me in a previous conversation that you've seen people lose their faith in situations where they've prayed for a miracle and then haven't got it. You know, I've prayed, I've been a good person, I've always gone to Mass, but, you know, now my cancer's come back. Mm-hmm. Is that something that, I mean, do you think in some ways that it can be a dangerous thing to pin your hopes on a miracle?
I have never actually been with people who've totally lost their faith because something didn't work the way they thought it would. You know, I was with a young man one night who he was married, he had a young family, and he came into the hospital for a procedure which would save his life. And after about 6 weeks, it was obvious it wasn't going to. And I sat with him the next day, and I sat in the room, and I just felt so hopeless and helpless and disappointed. It didn't, and I said it to him. And we'll call him John. I said, John, I just feel so helpless at the moment. And he turned up in the bed and he sat up, and he, for about an hour, he just went down this road of anger and why me, and, you know, I've got a young family and why not somebody less that this should happen to. And he was angry. But then over the next 2 weeks, his whole demeanor changed and he became very spiritual. And he never mentioned God in the sense of God, but he mentioned, oh, the man upstairs, or I'm on a journey, and things like that came into his conversation, which I never had with him before. And I remember being with his wife on the Friday night before he died, and she said how the 2 weeks prior to that, how beautiful they were to be with him. And she said, I didn't even think he was a spiritual man. Now, these things happen, and I still believe they happen because of the space we create through compassion and empathy for people to go into this space and not judge them and not criticize them and not advise them.
And in some respect, the fact of healing, whether the person is actually healed or not, is irrelevant. Or
I would call it a miracle. Now, it, you know, if it's not a big miracle, it's not the change in the water and the wine and the loaves and the fishes and all that. But it's still a miracle because people change, and I think they change when God enters into their life.
Well, we have in the New Testament many accounts of situations where people have been very sick at the point of death, or in one famous case actually dead, and they've been brought back from the brink. And yet Jesus, in a lot of these gospel accounts, seems to have had mixed feelings about miracles. And Andrew McGowan, this is something I want to ask you about. When he heals the nobleman's son, for example, in John's gospel, he says to the nobleman, unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. And you can also almost hear this sigh of resignation as he performs the miracle of healing. Do you sort of read that in the same way, as a certain ambivalence on Jesus' part?
Certainly. I think John's Gospel is a good example because there's a bit of contrast, in fact, in John compared to the other three canonical Gospels with the way in which miracles are presented as part of Jesus' ministry. There are only a handful of stories like that, and each time the story is accompanied by a discourse of Jesus in which he's really trying to make a point about who he is. And in each of those stories, a certain number of people see the miracle and go, wow, fantastic. But each time he goes on to address whoever is willing to listen, to really say, in effect, you know, the real point of this is something about who I am. And it's only those who understand that his message who've really experienced a genuine miracle. I mean, the example of the feeding of the 5,000, for instance, one of the few stories which occurs in all four of the Gospels, 5,000 people manage to have an interesting picnic, but the only ones who really benefit ultimately are those who hear him say and understand what he means when he says, "I am the bread of life." So actually the miracle itself in the modern sense, the sign itself, points to something else, which is him. And I think in the composition and construction of John's Gospel, even at that very early stage, we're actually seeing a measure of ambivalence on the part of Christians who are seeing others responding enthusiastically to whatever inexplicable events were going on in their midst, but who were perhaps not understanding the broader context of what faith in Jesus really meant.
Mm. The ambivalence comes through today as well, doesn't it? And it brings up an issue of pastoral care, which I'd like to put to you, Pat Power. From time to time, we hear stories in the media about miraculous phenomena, you know, modern phenomena, but they're usually along the lines of a statue of the Virgin that weeps, or someone bleeds from the hands and feet, or someone sees a fence post turn into an apparition of Mary. And they're often associated with Catholic believers, and they pose a challenge, I guess, to clerics, Catholic clerics, who want to credit the faith of those believers, but at the same time they feel uneasy at the sensational nature of these miracle claims. Do you share that unease, and how do you deal with that sort of situation when it comes up?
I must say I do share the unease, and certainly people's approach to places like Lourdes and Medjugorje and so on often have all that rather quirky, I suppose, attitude towards religion. But I think what it does do, it presents pastors, I think, with the opportunity to help people to come to a more, not so much rational attitude towards their faith, but to a more realistic one. And I think in doing that, I think the first thing that needs to be done is that those people need to be treated seriously and given the opportunity to be listened to, but also too, I'd hope, to be led on to a deeper faith and to see. I think Lourdes is a lovely example of it, that we often hear of Lourdes in terms of physical healing and so on, but really I think the magic, if you want to use that word, of Lourdes is that beautiful inner peace, that sense of communion that people experience, that learning from one another, the care that people have for one another. Michael Lyons used that gift that he gives to people of giving them space, and I think that in many ways I think Lourdes does that in a very beautiful way for the people that go there, and I think that's what the opportunity can be presented through some of these more extreme phenomena. I think the pastors then, I think, can have the opportunity to help people to interpret those in a way that will make more sense and more lasting sense in their lives. I think the real danger is for those people that they can be led up blind alleys and then come to see that it's futile, and then somehow or other experience deeper problems of faith. I think where people need to be led to is an understanding of God's love and the way that touches us in very ordinary ways. If I could just give a little example of something that happened here in Canberra last week, there were some children that were brought over from South Australia, and on last Wednesday night, the buses that they came on were set alight, and on Thursday morning, in the studio where I am here, there was an interview with the bus driver, and it was a really moving interview because he said, "Look, the buses are insured. I'm not so worried about that." But what really cut him up was the fact that the children had left on board the buses the presents that they'd bought to take home, and almost immediately the response to that was from all different sections of the community, with people offering to come to the help of those children. So in Friday's Canberra Times, there was a wonderful picture of those happy children, you know, returning back to their homes. And I think that was an example, really, of goodness overcoming the evil that was there. And I think that's ultimately what we're all about in trying to minister to people in those circumstances.
You're listening to Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio, and we will be taking your calls in just a few moments from now. So if you'd like to get your dialing finger limbered up, now's the time. The number to call is 1300 800 222. 1300 800 222. And we'll be hearing a little bit more from our panel, but if you'd like to start thinking about giving us a call, then do so, because we'll be opening the lines in just a few moments. We've heard Bishop Pat Power mention Lourdes, an interesting case, I think, in this discussion. It's the town in France where pilgrims flock to visit the grotto where Mary is said to have appeared and where miracles are said to take place. People come there to be healed in their hundreds and thousands. And Lourdes, as well as being a place of great faith and devotion, in the minds of a lot of people, it also represents the charlatanism or the fakery, if you like, associated with miracle claims. And Michael Lyons, I want to ask you, you mentioned to me in a previous conversation that you visited Lourdes this year. How did you find it? Did you find that faith and that devotion? And did you find that it was all a bit of a circus as well?
Yes, I about 2 months ago I was in Lourdes, actually, and I didn't know what I expect, even though being from Ireland, there's numerous pilgrimages to Lourdes from Ireland. A lot of people go there. But I left Lourdes, David, completely changed in my own way of looking at people, for instance, the disabled. Like when you see hundreds of thousands of people in wheelchairs or on beds there and praying, and if they're praying for miracles, which I'm sure they are, I think the miracle is in the fact there are so many people there, and they look at each other knowing that they weren't alone in the world, that there was other people disabled. That to me in itself was a great feeling of unity there. And to walk in the procession at night when there's probably 300,000 or 400,000 people in the rosary procession at night time, if you weren't moved some way, irrespective of your faith tradition and your beliefs, that and there's 10 million going to go to Lourdes this year because it's a Jubilee year. So 10 million people in this little village, which has got as many hotels nearly as Paris, it's just incredible. So to me, there's certainly a lot of the circus stuff and the commercialization outside the grotto area, and I suppose that's part of the world today of commercialized. But within it, I felt a great sense of reverence and sacredness within the grotto area itself, with the people over there.
I want to pick you up on a comment you made earlier about your work as a pastoral carer at St. Vincent's Hospital. And you talked about transformations where people confronted with serious illness have to come to terms with their own life and their own death. And you said that this is a miracle in itself. Can you tell me a little bit more about that process? Can you sort of describe that process and tell us what's miraculous about it?
Well, I suppose it's miraculous, David. I very rarely introduce probably God to a situation with people that I'm involved with. And I'm often with people, and often over a period of months. And I must say there's families involved as well. You're with the family and the patients. And this could be over months because of the procedures they're having. And over the months being with them, they start from a basis where they don't even want to enter any kind of religion into the interaction or space. But they do come to a space then later on where they do ask you to pray, and they do use words and terminologies that they didn't use earlier on, such as there's a higher power, or it's the man upstairs, and they mightn't even say God. So I don't know what, I don't introduce it. They seem to come up with this terminology and all that. And towards the end, if someone, often when people die, and as we said, people, all we need is dignity in death and as they say, a nice death, people can get very much at ease as they go through the process of death by conversations which have involved some spiritual aspect, which was not there in the beginning. I don't know why it's introduced, but it seems to come in, as Bishop Power said, again, in the space you create. I believe that God comes into that space with the patient. That's my only explanation. And if you're going to call it a miracle, called a miracle.
Well, people often say that life itself is a miracle, and people talk about the conception and birth of a child. You know, it's something that fills us with wonder. Death, on the other hand, is, you know, seen as horrible and grotty and unromantic. But from what you're saying, do you think that there is or there can be something miraculous about the process of dying?
Well, again, you've got to consider cultures. You know, different cultures have got different ways of handling death. Like in Ireland, it's still very much a celebration of a person's life. And that's because we're mainly predominantly Catholic, and, you know, we know that this is not the end. So we're celebrating a new beginning. where some other nationalities would take it differently. But it does vary depending on the person's culture as to how they approach death. But again, in a pastoral sense, irrespective of the cultures, I still believe that through pastoral encounter with patients, and incidentally, when I say pastoral, I'm not talking about me particularly. There's some great people out there, and they're not working in a structured situation I'm in, and they're good people, and they're very pastoral. And through their interaction with patients, they do come to a place in the space where death becomes okay. You know, it's dreadful and all that, but at the same time, at least it's dignified, and it's the anxiousness go out of it, and people have a nice death, as they say.
Well, on Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio, we're going to open the phone lines, and I've got a lot of winking lights on my phone in front of me here. Quite a few of you are keen to speak, so we'll take some calls. The number is 1-300-800-222. That's 1-300-800-222. And we're going to hear from Toby. Toby from the King's School. Good evening, Toby.
Good evening.
What would you like to tell us about?
Just on the topic of miracles. Yeah, one of my friends had a probably not a great steer, took it down to Scope Show, and it won first prize in the leading competition.
This was a steer, an animal that
yeah, a cow.
Wasn't very flash, but it won first prize.
Oh yeah, and like no one thought it would do well at all. Everyone thought it was just a throwout, pretty much.
Do you think that was a miracle or just a bit of a surprise?
Oh no, it was probably a miracle because it was really ugly.
Was it an answer to prayer?
Big one.
Was it an answer to prayer? Was there any prayer made, or it was just one of those things?
There was a few prayers made.
Yeah. Oh, well, there you go. That's not much you can say about that, really. It's it may well have been a miracle. Thanks for your call, Toby. We have Peter from Beverly Hills. Good evening, Peter.
G'day. I was curious to read in the Bible, I think it's in Acts or somewhere there, where the disciples were told to go out now and spread the word, and part of their assignment was to heal the sick, cleanse the lepers, and raise the dead as a matter of everyday, you know, work of a person representing Christ as a true Christian. So I don't see any real evidence of this in Christianity today. So is Christianity so watered down or so off course that power that's supposed to be traveling with true Christians is not there because of some misguidance from all the denominations? What's the story here? I mean, that's the commandment. Go out, cleanse lepers. You can do that with 12 months of medication, but you can't I don't see too many people raising the dead.
Are you saying there that if Christianity were a more vibrant faith, that people would be able to do these things that the disciples were sent out to do?
Absolutely.
A very interesting point. Andrew McGowan, what do you think about that?
I think the text being quoted is the New Testament equivalent of a throwaway line, David, as it were. I mean, there's also a line about, you know, if you had sufficient faith, you could move this mountain and so forth, or a tree and so on. So I think obviously that kind of statement is drawn together in the early Christians' experience because they had some experiences in which they really believed people had been raised from the dead, of course. And there's more than one story in the New Testament that suggests that in one way or the other. But I think it's also true that even those New Testament texts themselves present some of those stories as extraordinary things that weren't necessarily going to be the experience of every other Christian at every other time. So I would have to say that you know, the most enthusiastic fundamentalist or Pentecostalist Christian would probably have trouble maintaining that kind of standard of proof that was just suggested. But I'm fairly relaxed about it myself.
Well, why do you think we? I mean, it's a kind of a glib question in some ways, but in the world of the New Testament, as you mentioned earlier, was a world in which people had no trouble believing in miracles and demons and all kinds of supernatural occurrences. Does this partly explain why we find miracles in the Bible but not in our own culture, that just when people want to see these things, then they see them?
I think there's an element there we have to acknowledge of difference between that world and ours, that the area of the things we can't explain, as I said before, has become so much more circumscribed that there's a tendency perhaps for us to focus on that, you know, handful of phenomena that we still think we can't explain, you know, the things that perhaps Mary MacKillop might find one of to get her over the line, as it were, or the statue with the rosewater tears and so forth. But actually, I think that that narrowing of focus, the fact that there are so many other things we can now explain in different terms, challenges us to ask whether we can actually make theological sense of all those phenomena. Because I think, in fact, it's not a particularly Christian or religious point of view to suggest that the inexplicable is the primary arena for God's activity. I think that, in fact, as some of the stories we've heard, you know, from Michael about people dying a good death, that God's action has to be discernible in what we would otherwise call natural and supernatural phenomena. And the fact is that human experience is such that that line has shifted over time. But if God only belongs on the line, you know, across the line in the inexplicable, or in those things that are, as Hume says, violations of nature, then I don't think we're really dealing with the God of Christian faith or the God of the Bible, who is present and active in all kinds of phenomena, whether they're things we explain or things we can't.
1-300-800-222 is the number to call. 1-300-800-222. And let's hear from Kathleen. Kathleen's in Newcastle. G'day, Kathleen.
Well, I'm just ringing about my daughter. When she had cancer, she was told to go out to camp it out to a Jesuit priest for healing. So she went out and she wanted to go. And from then on, she said, I want to go to God. And when she was dying, the parapriest, the cancer doctor, came here, and he said, I've never seen anybody with so much faith. Really, in the young days, she went to church with me and that, but then later on, she didn't that much. And she said, I just want to go to God. And I felt like that was a very spiritual healing. And when she did go, Jesus gave me so much peace at that time, you wouldn't believe it.
Mm.
So I think spiritual healing is very important too.
And in a situation like that of such grief, that was something that you would call a miracle, was it?
It was a miracle. Mm.
Mm.
I felt like it was very peaceful, and up to the end she spoke and talked to us right up to the end. And but she always said to everybody, I'm going to God.
Mm.
And really it was, you know, she wasn't a church-going lady years. And so I think that was a miracle.
Thanks very much for your call, Wendy.
Okay, thanks.
Bye. We're going to hear next got some screen problems here. We're going to hear from Wendy in Lismore. Wendy, good evening. How are you?
Good, thanks.
What would you like to tell us this evening?
Well, I'm not Catholic, and I find it's a big problem being accepted by Catholics when you're not Catholic. And being of good faith, I do believe in Catholicism and the Catholics. I look up to them, you know. And I sort of, I don't make wishes, but it's just a coin of phrase. I wish the Catholics would accept more the Protestants that look up to them because they have the faith
mm-hmm.
of the Virgin Mary. And I've always shunned the Virgin Mary little because I believe in God. And I hate to say it, but I even don't look to Jesus so much, but as in his word, I do. I believe in God. And I, not being Catholic, I sort of creep around the Catholic church and the cathedral a little from time to time.
Like a few of us.
Yes. And I've sat on a bench at night in the grounds, and The statue of the Virgin wasn't there, but I always look at her when I walk past, and I sort of wonder why they have, well, why they pray to her and not to God. And and I was sitting on the bench, and, well, I was just sitting there, and she was there, you know, and she looked down on me, and she sort of gave me life's wonders and blessed me. And
this was Mary.
Yes, and I have faith in the Virgin, but as I say, I'm not Catholic, I'm Protestant, so I don't pray to her so much, but as she looked on me and gave me life's wonders and blessed my dear heart, I do feel for her from time to time.
And you ask a really good question there, Wendy. I mean, you said a minute ago that you don't understand why people pray to Mary, why people pray to Mary rather than to God. I mean, it's something that we're very familiar with in Catholic tradition, but it is, I mean, from the perspective of other faith traditions, it does seem rather strange. Bishop Pat Power, can you shed some light on that? What is it about Mary that makes her this sort of intercessory figure?
Wendy, I think you're pretty well on the right track with it all, because it's not so much a matter of praying to Mary or praying to Mary MacKillop. Really what it is identifying with them as fellow believers. And we'd see Mary's own beautiful faith and her own love for Jesus and love for the people in her life. We'd see that dramatically in the life of Mary MacKillop. So in some ways it's really, in those two cases, I suppose, looking at our big sister in faith and identifying with them and helping them to show us the way to lead us to Jesus. And we'd see Jesus as being the way, the truth and the life. And I think that's very much, I think, the approach that you've had. In terms of being welcomed by the Catholic Church, that I'd suggest you just go along and make yourself known to a priest or to a religious sister or someone like that. And I think that can help you to go further in your journey. But I think you are very much on the right track in the attitude that you have.
This is Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio, and we're talking about miracles. The number to call if you'd like to have a chat with us is 1300 800 222. And we're going to hear from Marie in Burwood. Good evening, Marie.
Hello, David.
How's it going?
Not bad. I wanted to tell you about a Christian brother that I met who went to Lourdes because he was losing his sight. He actually did lose his sight in the course of that journey. But he said that what he gained in that the experience was a great sense of acceptance and a great deal of peace from it. He was relatively young, I think, at the time, and he went on then to do some very valuable work in education for blind Catholic blind children and welfare work for older people that probably he and perhaps the Catholic Church in Melbourne, where he lived, would not have undertaken at all had his situation not occurred. So sometimes when you may wish and pray for something, you get something else, which in the end is of greater benefit perhaps to you and to other people.
That's a good point. You don't necessarily see it coming, do you?
No.
Thanks for your call, Mari. Let's hear from Debbie in Central Victoria. Good evening, Debbie.
Hello.
What would you like to share with us this evening?
Yeah, just a comment on Mary MacKillop.
Sure.
And the miracles required to have her canonised, of course. And I just think that the Catholic Church is placing far too much emphasis on the old rabbit out of the hat miracle and not enough emphasis on the fact that she was so miraculous in everything she did.
What do you mean by that? In what way was she miraculous in everything she
did?
Well,
I think if you look, I've even got a calendar here, the Mary Mac calendar for the year. Just some really amazing words that she said over the years, which reflected her attitude to life, which is for October this year, for example. When I could not see my way, God kept my heart full of trust. Simple, really good living things. Those sort of things, I think, are really underrated. And as far as I'm concerned, the Catholic Church, well, it's a bit blokey to me. It needs evidence. It needs one person's life saved. Won't necessarily change the world, mind you, but one person's life saved appears to be enough to be called a miracle.
Mm. But don't you need something more than just edifying thoughts? I mean, what you're talking about, what you just read there, there would be a lot of people in Catholic tradition or in various Christian traditions who have had that kind of insight, but we wouldn't make them all saints, would we?
Well, not everyone turns it into a lifestyle and creates the sort of educational and looking after the poor opportunities that she did for our country. I mean, it was a lifestyle that she made of that. It wasn't just the few words that she spoke. And I think that, frankly, she probably wouldn't want to be beatified if it all depended on a few blokes sitting there in the Vatican deciding whether or not someone had pulled a rabbit out of a hat. And I think, you know, her life and the fact that she was even kicked out of the Catholic Church for a time there, when she broke the rules, she didn't like the rules. And I really do think, look, she's probably sitting up there quite happy to wait until people decide that the old cheap trick, the old cheap miracle, isn't good enough for her.
Well, Bishop Pat Power, I can't not pass this one over to you. Is that what we're looking at here, a few blokes sitting around in the Vatican waiting to pull a rabbit out of a hat?
I suppose that judgment is certainly part of the whole process, but those other things that Debbie talked about, they're very much part of the whole of bringing Mary MacKillop to where she is today. I think it's precisely because people have experienced that, because they've acknowledged it, they've been edified by it, the fact that their lives have been transformed by it. I think that's precisely why she is recognised as a blessed, and almost certainly will be canonised. So I don't think that it's a question of just narrowly focusing on the miracle. It's something that I said right early in the piece, that a miracle's not a standalone event, but really it needs to be something that's seen in the context of the whole of in this case, Mary MacKillop's life. And as Debbie said, there's been many wonderful examples in her life of what true discipleship is all about.
Well, we've heard some really interesting comments tonight, and we're getting on to the end of the hour, so we're going to have to wrap it up there. I'll just say thank you very much for your calls, everyone who rang in. I'm just going to ask each of my guests very briefly, if you could summon up a miracle, what would it be? Michael Lyons.
Well, I suppose it's a wonderful event that cannot be explained by the laws of nature.
If I said I could arrange one for you, what would you pick?
I don't know. You got me, Dave. I couldn't think that so quickly about that one.
Too many to choose from.
Be too many. But also, I suppose I understand that sometimes the miracle is in the timing rather than the event too, which often happens in life.
Sure.
You come into somebody's life for some unknown reason, and it's the timing as opposed to the event that I believe where the miracle lies.
Andrew McGowan, what's your preferred miracle?
The last time I remember actively praying for one, David, was early in the fourth quarter of the recent grand final. Speaking as a Geelong supporter, it's those kinds of moments when you realise there are no atheists in foxholes. I'm happy to believe that the miraculous is a part of my life from day to day for all sorts of reasons, David.
Just about out of time. Michael Lyons, Professor Andrew McGowan and Bishop Pat Power, thanks very much to all of you for coming on the program.
Thanks, David.